Hello and welcome to our first edition of Property Patter. My name is Emma Humphreys and I'm a partner at Charles Russell Speechleys. I'm joined today by two associates from our property litigation team to talk about the Landlord and Tenant Act 1954. Now the Act's been in force for 65 years and it's led to a lot of interesting case law. For those listeners who are still not sure what it's all about, it was designed to protect business tenants who have invested in their office, shop, warehouse or whatever it may be from being kicked out without good reason. Those reasons are set out in Section 30 of the Act. There are seven grounds which, if proved, allow a landlord to terminate a tenant's lease and regain possession. On the other side, where a landlord is willing to allow a tenant to stay, the 1954 Act provides certain rules about how a lease should be renewed. If the parties can't agree on the terms of the new lease, then the court will step in and decide, including as to duration and rent if necessary. Now, as I say, I've got two associates here to talk about the 54 Act today. The challenge I've set them is to give me two need-to-know points each about the Act. We're going to aim to come up with the top three out of that. And the person whose ground doesn't make it into the top three is going to make us all a cuppa at the end of this and donate £5 to our charity of the year, Blisma. So, I'm joined firstly by Samuel Lear. Sam, over to you. Do you want to make a start? Which point do you want to go with first?
Well, hello everybody. So as you already alluded to, Emma, lease renewals can be a bit of a minefield and there's a huge amount of case law. So the first point I wish to make concerns something really quite straightforward and basic that practitioners and parties can often miss, which is to ensure that they diarise all their dates. It's very easy for people to get too bogged down with the detail of their case without actually dealing with the fundamentals. So I would always recommend that the relevant dates are diarised, particularly the expiry date of any lease. And ideally, parties should begin to consider their strategy around 18 months prior to the lease expiry and preferably involve their solicitor. For instance, if you're a landlord and you currently have a contracted out lease, for instance, if you miss the lease expiry date, then there's a risk that if a tenant holds over for a sufficient period of time, then the landlord has unwittingly granted the tenant security of tenure, which could have severe consequences. And the same is also true for the 1954 Act protected leases, particularly concerning the expiry date of any Section 25 or Section 26 notices. Again, the consequences for missing a relevant date can be pretty severe. If you are a tenant, the consequence of inaction is that you'll lose your right to renew a lease if the deadline is missed and the tenancy will come to an end on the date of the expiry of the lease. Even if you're just slow to act and there's little time for a tenant to reach an agreement with the landlord, the tenant will then either need to agree an extension or run the risk of incurring the costs of a court claim. There are also tactical advantages to be gained by considering the position early. For instance, in a rising market in terms of rent, a landlord might want to serve a notice as soon as possible to benefit from a higher market rent, and the same is true for tenants in a falling market. But anyway, whichever way you look at it, although it should go without saying, it is a need to know for parties and practitioners alike to be well on top of the relevant dates so that they can plan their strategy and not run the risk of losing their most basic rights.
So what you're saying, Sam, is that really, to you, this is a key point because actually it's one for landlords and tenants. Both of them need to be very aware of their dates, planning in advance, and looking at how the market is doing, is likely to do in the upcoming months. Is that a fair summary of your first need to know?
Well, absolutely. A bit like Brexit, the clock is always ticking, and if you're not quick to act, then it's only going to work against you.
Oh, the B word. We've already come to the B word. Fine. Well, that sounds all very sensible to me. Is there anything else you want to add before I ask Oliver what his first point is?
Nope. Just be wary of your dates.
Get your diaries out.
Absolutely.
Okay. Oliver, over to you. What's your first? Sorry, I should say Oliver Park, another associate in our team. Welcome.
Thank you.
What's your first plan? What's your first need to know?
So, I mean, I think this is definitely a slightly more niche point than Sam's, but I don't think that makes it any less important. So what the point I want to cover is how the courts will deal with imposing new terms on the parties if the parties cannot agree the new terms between themselves. Obviously, the vast majority of lease renewals where both parties agree that there should be a new lease, then the landlord and tenant will agree the terms between themselves perfectly amicably. That doesn't always happen. And what I particularly wanted to cover was Section 35 of the Landlord and Tenant Act, 1954, which is when the parties are not in agreement and the court is imposing new terms on lease terms on the parties, is that the court should have regard to the terms of the current tenancy and to all relevant circumstances.
Yes.
As people familiar with this area will know, one of the key cases on how the court should exercise its discretion is OME and City of London Real Property Co. Limited, which laid down the principles of how the court should exercise its discretion.
Yeah, that true story. I once actually had a tenant solicitor on the other side return the draft lease to my transactional colleague with literally OME, OME, OME written against virtually every clause. So yes, OME, yes, big case, important
case. So the starting point, as laid down in OME, is that the court should have regard to the terms of the original lease, because it is supposed to be a renewal. You know, the court doesn't want to interfere in the commercial bargain that the party struck previously.
Yes.
Or impose terms that neither party actually really wants. The onus is therefore on the party that's proposing the change to persuade the court that the change to the terms of the lease should be put into effect. Change proposed must be fair and reasonable, and it's particularly likely to be deemed unfair or not reasonable when a party is trying to radically alter the bargain between the parties. The court should have regard to the potentially weak negotiating position of the tenant, and importantly, the court isn't intending to freeze the terms of the lease. So, you know, were there good reasons to change it, the court, you know, will be prepared to act. But as with all these things, the court wishes to emphasise that it has wide discretion as to the terms it imposes on the parties. Just because something is market practice doesn't necessarily mean that the court will decide to include it in the new lease, but market practice can be evidence of what is fair and reasonable.
So your first need-to-know point really is that, and I think this does come as a shock to a lot of, certainly tenants, but even some landlords, is actually the very fact that this level of analysis goes on in the court. Mm. You know, it's not just about two parties deciding the terms on which they're going to renew the lease. If it's 54 Act protected, actually what we're talking about is if you can't agree it, the court will actually step in.
And I think it goes to a broader point that while it's very easy just to, you know, oh, we've already got a lease, it'll be fine, you do need to consider whether, you know, the environment's changed, whether the statute has imposed any different obligations that need to be reflected in the new lease.
That's right, because you're assuming something's going to be carried forward, but actually it might not be.
It might not be appropriate.
Okay. Well, that's great. Thanks, Oliver. Some more to think about. Sam, let's come back to you with your need-to-know point two.
So my second argument is linked in some way to my first. If a landlord is seeking to oppose a new tenancy, it will need to work quickly to prepare its case. In light of a fairly recent tenant-friendly decision, this has become even more important. In fact, very few cases in recent years have put the cat amongst the property litigation pigeons as much as the case of S. Francis and Cavendish Hotel. By way of a very quick summary for those who aren't aware of this case, and by way of background, if a landlord is seeking to oppose a new tenancy, it must rely on a particular ground as prescribed under the Act. The most popular ground is arguably ground F, which provides that a landlord can oppose a new tenancy if it intends to redevelop the premises. Now, the matter of intention was fundamental to this case. Now, prior to this case, some cynical landlords might have prepared a scheme of works which had no practical utility other than as a method of merely seeking possession from the tenant. Now, in this case, the landlord was brazen about this. It was very open that the purpose of its scheme was to remove the tenant, and it was not designed for any other purpose. It is perhaps more common in practice that a landlord genuinely does want to carry out some redevelopment works, but it, you know, might beef up its scope of work to ensure that it obtains possession by making them substantial. Now, in this case, the court decided that the intention was conditional. If the tenants had left voluntarily, the landlords would not have carried out the works. It was as simple as that. Now, how this decision will fall out remains to be seen, but it is clear that landlords are going to have to think through their redevelopment schemes very carefully to ensure that they meet the new acid test, demonstrating that it would carry out the works regardless of commercial utility and notwithstanding the tenant leaving voluntarily. It was already the case that landlords have significant hurdles to overcome in establishing a Ground F case, but this decision means that opposed renewal claims under Ground F are likely to become more complex, lengthy and expensive, as courts will now start to take a more forensic look at the landlord's intention.
I mean, that's the thing with this, Francis, isn't it? It doesn't necessarily change the law. There's been a lot of debate about it, but one thing I think it does do is mean that the evidence is going to be potentially examined a lot more thoroughly when it comes to intention, isn't it?
That's absolutely right. And there have been a couple of cases that have followed the Francis decision, so courts are beginning to forensically examine the scheme of works far more carefully than perhaps he did before.
And I mean, it comes back a little bit to your first point. I mean, your first point was about diarising dates and you know, thinking ahead. And when it comes to a Ground F case, I mean, that's always been the case, hasn't it? We've always emphasised the importance of getting ready early, even though there's case law that's quite helpful if you're a bit disorganised and leave it late. But you know, after S. Francis, I personally would be a lot more nervous about that idea. I was already nervous about the idea. Even more nervous now about the idea of, you know, rocking up to trial and pulling everything together at the last minute, because again, it's going to raise that question mark, isn't it? Do you actually intend to do this? Because if you haven't got your ducks in a row.
Well, that's right. And courts will see right through any cynical attempts. They will no longer be ignored. So in order to prepare a substantial scheme of works that is going to pass muster with the courts, it's going to require a lot of thought and preparation, involving potentially a lot of, you know, a few experts to ensure that it's watertight.
Yeah, fine. So it's clear you are a very organised property litigator, Sam. All about the diarising for point one, and all about the getting prepared for point two.
I do try to be.
Oliver, right, your second point, please.
So my second point is one that does sound rather obvious, but it has led to litigation in the past, is that for the Landlord-Tenant Act 1954 to apply, the tenant need actually to be in occupation of at least part of the premises for business purposes. Mm. And what this means is the courts have increasingly been willing to find that the requirements are actually quite, you know, not very particularly stringent on the tenant. So I think it's an obvious trap for the landlords to think that maybe the tenant isn't in occupation, when in fact it is. The tribunal will look at whether an element of control is exercised over the relevant premises, and whether the tenant is actually making use of them. To come up with a couple of examples, a local authority was found to be in occupation of a park for the 1954 Act, because it had arranged for a third party to cut the grass and maintain the park. Similarly, a company that had a lease of an advertising hoarding, which changed the advert on the hoarding occasionally and carried out basic maintenance, was again, you know, found to have been in occupation of the hoarding for business purposes.
Yeah, that's a tricky one, being in occupation of a hoarding.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Sounds kind of counterintuitive.
Does a
bit. It's worth also saying that if the tenant is not in occupation of the premises for their due to factors outside of their control, then they still have the benefit of the 54 Act, which obviously is very sensible. There's no reason why the tenant should be necessarily penalised and deprived a new lease because a fire breaks out 6 months before the end of the term. And it's worth also saying that counts if that also applies if there are structural repairs to a property which are the landlord's responsibility, and the tenant has to vacate for that reason. So I guess that is again designed to stop unscrupulous landlords trying to engineer a situation where the tenant has to leave shortly before the lease comes up.
Yes.
Whether the tenant is still in occupation of the premises depends on whether the thread of continuity of them running the business has been broken or not. So there was a case where the landlord bought a post-new lease on Ground F. Landlord won at first instance, the tenant ceased trading, obviously good. But they did also appeal. When they subsequently won on appeal, there was then the question mark of, well, are they actually in occupation for business business purposes? Because, you know, obviously, completely legitimately, they'd stopped trading prepared after the first decision.
Yeah.
Because,
yeah.
You know, as you would.
As you would, yes.
And looking at the circumstances, the court came to the common sense decision that, you know, there was sufficient continuity so they were able to have the protection of the Act still.
And that must bring in intention a bit, I guess, as well. It comes back to the sort of slightly S. Francis zone, isn't it? You know, they're looking kind of at physical arrangements on the ground, but also kind of what are those physical arrangements demonstrating? Are they demonstrating the intention to...
And it is very subjective. Woodfall gives the example of a seasonal business where, say, you run an ice cream kiosk by the seaside in the summer. You know, if your lease ran out in the winter and you weren't there, would you be in occupation? And it's likely that, again, it's kind of quasi-intention, because if you, every single year for the entire term, have vacated it for 6 months, well, not vacated it, left, not been in occupation necessarily physically for 6 months of the year, but have come back every summer, then it's likely the court will infer, you know, that you do have the requisite intention.
Ice cream sellers beware. That's
yes.
The point, isn't it? I have to say, I think that's my favourite point, because the occupation for business purposes is something that I have used a lot to landlord advantage, because tenants don't always realise that actually the rights you were talking about earlier for the court to be getting involved in the terms of the new lease and all these other things you've been talking about, they actually only apply when someone's actually in occupation for business purposes. And it's quite easy actually sometimes, particularly with mixed use situations, if you've got a lease which has got, let's say, a shop below and residential parts above, and sometimes tenants end up living in the residential parts and forgetting the fact that actually their right to stay there is based on the commercial occupation. I think that's my favourite point so far. Just because I've used it a lot.
Yeah, I mean, it's worth pointing out that it doesn't actually require very much for the tenant to be in occupation for business purposes.
No.
So Poynton York Group PLC v and Doreen Poulton was a case where essentially a tenant had sublet a premises for a number of years, hadn't been in occupation themselves throughout this time. The sublease ended 3 days before the head lease ended, and the tenant decided that it would reoccupy the premises. And the steps it had taken basically to reoccupy and communicated this to the landlord were basically to park some cars in the parking spaces it was allowed to under the lease, and supervise, I think, some sort of basic kind of maintenance works for the end of the sub-tenancy. And the court decided that the parking spaces and the limited kind of end-of-tenancy oversight that they had was sufficient.
Mm.
The landlord had changed the locks. Obviously, you hadn't realised the tenant was planning to resume it in business purposes, business premises. So that, it's just a word of warning for landlords who are thinking of relying on this. That actually, even if the degree of use seems to be pretty minimal, you have to be very careful.
Yes, no, that's a very good point actually. And as you say, Poynton and Poulton, remember, it was quite minimal sort of contractors popping into sort of few bits out sort of thing. So, as you say, the landlord, wouldn't necessarily have been aware of that.
Yeah. One final point just to show how important it is to take specialist legal advice is that...
good plug on that.
is that unlawful business use, so in breach of covenant, doesn't count for the purpose. So if you're not allowed to use the premises for business purposes and, say you were running a shop from it, you wouldn't be able to rely on the 54 Act.
I think in terms of our need to know points, I think, all four of those have been, all very valid points for people to be aware of. I think I've already said my favourite is definitely the occupation for business purposes, so that's definitely in there. I think we should also definitely have Sam's point on diarising dates. I think that's... Nobody talks about the 54 Act, do they, without talking about dates at some point and diarising. Very important. So then it's just a decision between, do we go with how the terms get decided, or do we go with the preparation. They're both equally valid. And this is a question of who's now going to go off and make the tea and donate the fiver. I am actually, though, I am going to go with the how the terms get decided and Oliver, because I do think it does come as a shock to a lot of people that actually, if you can't agree, the court has to get in there and sort it out. And of course, we now have the tribunal also in Central London cases deciding things, and that's even speeding the whole process up. So I think I'm going to go with that. I'm very torn. I'm sorry, Sam.
Put the kettle on.
Put the kettle on, get your fiver out. And that is us done. Thank you very much indeed for joining us, and I hope you found that informative.